Either of you have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor.
Then, Mr. Rappel, you may proceed.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, counsel. My name is Mark Rappel. I represent the appellant in this matter, Trent Esch. This is a direct appeal from the District Court of Custer County, Nebraska, following a jury trial. The facts in this case aren't largely in dispute. The facts clearly established that on July 11th of 2020, the appellant did go to the victim's house, shot the victim multiple times, causing the victim's death. These actions resulted in Mr. Esch being charged with three crimes: first-degree murder, use of a firearm to commit a felony, and possession of a firearm by a prohibited person. The only issue at trial really was Mr. Esch's state of mind in this case. This isn't a whodunit or how it happened. It's more what his state of mind was. The only issues really the jury had to decide was, did the appellant purposely kill the victim with premeditated malice, deliberate premeditated malice, or did he intentionally kill the victim without premeditated malice and without provocation of sudden quarrel, or did he kill the victim deliberately with provocation of sudden quarrel? The jury found him guilty of first-degree murder, use of a firearm to commit a felony, and possession of a firearm by a prohibited person. The primary issues on this direct appeal are the jury instructions that were given and some claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. Plain error did occur in this case when the trial court did instruct the jury as to intoxication. Instruction number 16 of the jury instructions clearly showed that the jury was instructed that intoxication could be a defense and would go to the required intent to commit the crime.
Is that the pattern jury instruction, the Nebraska jury instruction?
It used to be, Your Honor. However, that jury instruction was essentially nullified largely based upon the passage of Nebraska Revised Statute Section 29-122, which really limited the circumstances in which intoxication could be instructed to the jury, and none of those issues existed in this particular case.
When you say used to be, is it still part of the pattern jury instructions?
I believe it is, Judge, but I believe, again, it's very limited circumstances in which the person either becomes intoxicated because they don't know they're taking an intoxicating substance, or their involuntary intoxication type of case. The facts in this case didn't warrant it, and I believe the state concedes that as well. I think the issue is whether or not it's plain error in this particular case, and that's where we need to shift to the next analysis, which would be what the standard is when you analyze a situation like this. And when we're talking about situations where the jury was improperly instructed, this court must analyze whether or not this guilty verdict, the guilty verdicts that were rendered in this case, were surely unattributable to that error.
And the state contends that the instruction that was given is actually more beneficial to Mr. Esch than what the statute would be. Is there any validity to that argument?
Your Honor, I would respond to that. I would say on the surface it may appear that the defendant was given the benefit of a potential windfall, if you will, with a jury instruction that he wasn't otherwise entitled to. However, I would respond to that in two ways. Number one, the way it was argued, Mr. Esch didn't get the benefit of that instruction because his trial counsel largely conceded that it wasn't an offense for large portions of the jury instruction. But I would secondly argue that even if the intoxication instruction was given and the defendant benefited by that, you still have to focus on the instructions as a whole and whether or not they caused confusion. When we're talking about these cases, the issue is solely through the prism of, could have this caused confusion to the jury, and does record surely establish that this error was not attributable to that error? So when we're looking at that standard, Your Honor, you must consider whether the error was harmless or was it prejudicial.
What do you think the theory was that trial counsel used in the case?
Your Honor, I could see that as I read the trial counsel's arguments during closing arguments, I was really kind of confused about his theory and where he was going with this. And that's where I think it exacerbates the confusion. The factors the courts can look at are, you know, the jury instructions as a whole. Do they clarify the ambiguity or confusion? And number two, does the evidence presented or the manner in which the case was argued eliminate that confusion? And the way in which trial counsel argued this issue to the jury, I would argue, is muddled and very, very confusing. At one point, trial counsel states that intoxication is not a defense. In fact, he stated, quote, it's never a legitimate defense. And so he goes out to say, not only is intoxication not a defense in this case, it could never be a legitimate defense because otherwise defendants would just get drunk and then they blame themselves on the intoxication.
It doesn't even want to say it still impacts his state of mind, and when we're intoxicated, we don't know what we're really doing, can't form a state of mind. I mean, so he's kind of trying to tie it to this issue, isn't he?
And that's my next point. I think that adds to the confusion. On the one hand, he's saying it's not a defense, it's never a defense, it can never be a legitimate defense. But then he's saying things such as intoxication did impact the appellant's ability to form intent. Intoxication is not a defense, but it's relevant. It's not a defense, but it, quote, fogs the brain. I was really lost with where he was going with those arguments. To me,
well, isn't he saying it's not a defense, but it might be relevant to some element that the state has to prove?
In the context of a first-degree murder case, I'm struggling to see what the relevance would be. The only argument
he's saying it's relevant to intent, whether the requisite intent was formed.
Well, again, when we analyze this case, I think you especially got to analyze and not lose sight of the fact this was a first-degree murder case.
Sure, and it's an element of first-degree murder.
Correct, but the element, the step instructions of first-degree murder are very, very complicated. They're full of legalese. Many of the definitions in the first-degree, second-degree, and manslaughter have their own definitions embedded into the instructions as well. And so when you've got an instruction essentially that says by the court injecting the intoxication defense in when it shouldn't have, that instruction caused the confusion because essentially if you read the sudden quarrel instruction in conjunction with the first degree and second degree murder instructions, it causes confusion because essentially the intoxication defense is saying it could be a defense to first or second degree murder, but if you look at the definition of the way the court instructed on sudden quarrel, of manslaughter, you cannot consider that peculiarity with this particular defendant. So I'm really struggling to where the manner in which he argued that, how that really tied that all together. And I'm not sure it could have rectified the confusion. It's just there, when you look at the instructions as a whole, you know, again, the factors these courts have looked at are, you know, you look at the instructions as a whole, you look at whether or not the case was argued clearly. The instructions themselves are inherently confusing. They contradict each other, the instructions by themselves. Then instead of coming in and defense counsel kind of taking advantage of the error of intoxication or clarifying the ambiguity, I'm really puzzled as to what his theory was when he's saying things such as it fogs the brain, it's not a defense, but it's relevant. It did impact his ability to form intent. Again, I think it's a situation where, in fact, if you read the argument even further and listen to his arguments, he even used the phrase he snapped, the appellant snapped, and he suggested that basically the state had not met the burden of providing psychological evidence that the appellant was not insane. So he's also injecting a half-baked insanity argument. to convict the client. The evidence was, what should he have been convicted of? And we can't sit here and say, this court, I can't sit here and say today, we know exactly what the jury would have done if the jury would not have been instructed on intoxication. And again, this wasn't the only improper instruction. I would argue that, that this court also erred in instructing the jury on the burden not shifting on the first and second degree murder case, but did shift on the use and possession of firearm cases. Again, there's now two errors in these instructions that I would argue that when you look at the body of everything, cause even more confusion. And that this is a rare case. As I looked at these cases in preparation for today, I don't believe this court has ever found a jury instruction case where it went solely to state of mind, jury error case. Now, in this case, again, if you look at the cases in the past, this is a relatively new concept for this court. I believe in State versus Dady back in 2019 is when the court kind of looked at some of these and started listing the factors of the jury instructions as a whole and the evidence at trial and the closing arguments. But I don't believe they've ever done it in the context of just state of mind. And when it comes to state of mind, that's a jury question.
What is our latest pronouncement under 29-122? What's the right way to charge?
Well, I believe, Your Honor.
If any.
Yeah, I believe, Your Honor, the standard would be, again, if you have one of those rare cases where the person either doesn't know they're taking an intoxicating substance or there's involuntary intoxication, then perhaps the intoxication instruction would be appropriate. But that would be my understanding, Your Honor. So I'd ask to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Doug. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Liss, good morning to you.
Morning, Your Honors. Morning, Mr. Apple. May it please the Court, Nathan Liss, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Appellees in Nebraska. Ash is assigned seven errors on appeal. He's focused on the two claims regarding the jury instruction, so I will do the same. The jury instruction on the defense of intoxication and the jury instruction on the elements of first-degree murder and the state's burden of proof. As far as the jury instruction on the defense of intoxication, we maintain this claim is not properly before this court, given that there was no objection to this instruction at trial, but in any event, it does not amount to plain error. The fact that the instruction was given, even though Esch was not entitled to it under 29-122, was not a miscarriage of justice because it was beneficial to him.
So if your position is that the instruction wasn't warranted, what is your position on whether the instruction was a correct statement of the law in any event?
Well, I'm not sure.
Whether or not it was warranted, was it a correct statement of the law?
It was a correct statement of the law as the law used to be prior to 29-122. It's still in NJI, of course, and that's been subject of question here. I guess our position is that it's not no longer a correct statement of the law, given that 29-122 has clarified that voluntary intoxication is not a defense. It's only a defense if it's involuntary. It's still NJI, and we do have a few cases since State v. Abugide which contain language that suggests that voluntary intoxication could potentially be a viable defense, which I think is still causing some confusion, and that's just so you know why the state didn't object to the instruction in this case. They weren't sure what the state of the law was and what position they should take, and they didn't want to object and have the defense be denied the defense and have a potential problem with that. But to answer your question, I don't think that voluntary intoxication is a correct statement of the law anymore, and we would ask you to once again revisit this and clarify that the instruction should not be given unless 29-122
is satisfied. Should we say something about which party has the burden of proof if 29-122 is at play?
Well, I mean, you've addressed that a few times, in State v. Abugide in particular. But I think the message there was, unless and until a defendant actually comes forward and produces some evidence that the intoxication was involuntary, we need not delve into, what exactly do they carry, just merely the burden of persuasion versus the burden of proof, and is there some sort of constitutional problem if you do actually carry the burden of persuasion? You didn't go there in Abugide, and I assume there would be no reason to go there in this case, again, given that there was no dispute that this all the intoxication
I'm not
was voluntary.
Sure what your ultimate argument is here. Does the state want its cake and eat it too?
Well, our argument is that the instruction shouldn't have been given. because he wasn't entitled to it. The evidence didn't warrant it. But to the extent it was given, I mean, they're alleging it was plain error to have given it despite the fact that they weren't entitled to it and the evidence didn't warrant it. And our position is that to the extent it was given, even though it shouldn't have been,
well,
it was harmless.
Actually, there's, wasn't not there evidence that he was intoxicated? There was some alcohol involved?
Yeah, it was undisputed.
And some history of alcoholism, was there not?
There was. Right. It was undisputed that...
So, why would it be improper for the court not to give some, to have an instruction on alcohol?
Because our legislature has done away with the defense of voluntary intoxication and codified by statute that voluntary intoxication is no longer a defense.
But you did not object to it. The state did not object to it.
The state did not. Neither party objected to it. But I'm agreeing with the appellant that it shouldn't have been given since it's by statute. It's no longer a valid defense and shouldn't be a valid instruction. But
you say it's not prejudicial. Is that position of the state?
Right. To the extent it was given, and we're talking about was there any harm here, our response is that there wasn't, that it was harmless because it was only beneficial. There's really no conceivable harm from the fact that the defense received this.
Mr. Esch says it muddies the waters. It ties into the closing argument that seems to convolute the issue, creates confusion to the jury. What's the state's position there?
We would disagree with that. There seems to be sort of two components to their argument in that regard. Number one, the trial counsel didn't do a very good job or a good enough job of arguing this. As noted in our brief, first and foremost, they haven't assigned error with respect to trial counsel's alleged deficient performance in that regard. This is a claim that the district court committed plain error by giving this instruction. Additionally, we would note, as we did in our brief, that the trial counsel did, in my view, a good job, a competent job of arguing intoxication to the jury. And trial counsel specifically argued that it was relevant to the issue of premeditation because it's common knowledge that intoxication inhibits a person's ability to make rational decisions, which is a fact you can't ignore and create a reasonable doubt as to whether Esch had the requisite intent to commit first-degree murder. So I don't think there was any, certainly no significant deficiency with how trial counsel argued this. And then as far as the second component of the appellant's argument, if I understand it correctly, with respect to the potential confusion here between giving intoxication and then the definition of sudden quarrel as it fell within deliberate and the fact that sudden quarrels as intoxication is not to be considered, I guess my responses to that are, number one, well, it was still relevant to the issue of premeditation, even if for some reason it was offset or not to be considered for deliberate because of the definition of sudden quarrel, it's still relevant to premeditation, and that's how it was argued. Number two, we would submit that he can't show prejudice.
So you think that's improper under whatever the legislature was trying to do?
Is there anything improper with doing away with intoxication in light of the fact that definition?
I think I just heard you say that that defense counsel did a good job of arguing that alcohol can have something to do with intent. Did I misunderstand that argument?
No.
So is that incompatible with the statute as it now exists?
Arguably, but given that the instruction was given, my point is that defense counsel did a good job of using that instruction and arguing that it could potentially negate intent in this case. If the instruction had not been given, which it's our position it shouldn't have been, then that argument wouldn't have been available. That wouldn't be a correct argument because voluntary intoxication shouldn't be allowed to negate premeditation in light of 29-122. But
you'll concede that it's a little unusual to be arguing that defense counsel competently argued an instruction that was erroneously given.
Well, it was a beneficial instruction, so to the extent it was given, I would expect defense counsel to utilize it and argue it in their favor. I understand it's a bit unseemly, but it's the position that we're in because the instruction, in our view, shouldn't have been given, but it was. So what's defense counsel to do in the event that you get a beneficial instruction that you the parties are agreeing you shouldn't be entitled to. I would think you'd attempt to utilize it in your client's favor. I don't think that you would go up there and not use it. So I think any competent defense attorney would use it. I think that defense counsel in this case did a good job of using it to the best of their ability. It didn't work out, but that doesn't mean that it was prejudicial error. It was potentially beneficial to the defense here and only beneficial in our view. There was no conceivable prejudice from it. There's no way the jury would have found him guilty because of that jury instruction. It potentially allowed them to find that intent was lacking and acquit him of one or more offenses, but it couldn't have gone the other way and prejudiced him in that regard. And I guess the final point I would make on that is to the extent that the appellant's arguing that this is prejudicial and should have been given, you know, what in the event that were true, what would the remedy be here? They're arguing that he shouldn't have got this intoxication instruction. It's caused confusion, and the remedy here should be a new trial in which he doesn't get this instruction that he's not entitled to. I don't entirely follow the remedy there. That doesn't compute in our view. I don't see how you could have potential prejudice or at least just confusion here from getting an instruction you're not entitled to that in our view is only beneficial. But even if there is confusion there, the remedy would be that we go back and we have a new trial where we don't give this instruction that they're claiming they shouldn't have received anyway. So we would submit that if this court addresses this claim, despite the fact that it was not raised below, any error in giving the instruction was harmless and does not amount to plain error. Just briefly on the jury instruction on the elements of first-degree murder and the state's burden of proof, we would maintain that this claim is also not properly before this court, given that there was no objection to this instruction at trial either, but in any event, it does not amount to plain error. Ash claims that the elements instruction on his murder charge was improper and amounted to reversible error because even though the instruction expressly set forth the state's burden of proof, it did not also state that the state's burden never shifts. We submit this was not plain error given that the jury instructions as a whole contained several accurate advisements about the state's burden. The state's burden of proof was included in the elements instruction for each of the three offenses for which Esch was charged with. The state's burden of proof was also included in the homicide step instruction. There was also a separate instruction defining proof beyond reasonable doubt, which is a correct statement of the law and consistent with NJI. And there was also a separate instruction on the presumption of innocence, which stated that Esch is presumed to be innocent. That means you must find him not guilty unless and until you decide that the state has proved him guilty beyond reasonable doubt. Now, we submit that these instructions read together accurately instructed the jury regarding the state's burden of proof. We see no basis to conclude that despite these instructions, the jury would have somehow, for some reason, believed that the state's burden shifted at some point on the murder charge. Lastly, we would briefly note that the Nebraska Court of Appeals recently addressed and rejected a similar claim to that being raised in State v. Barber. I did not cite this in my brief, but it's 28 NEBAP 820. That's from 2020. Ironically, Judge Pirtle authored it, and Mr. Apple and I were on the case. The Court of Appeals decision is obviously not binding on this court, but we would submit that it's correct and persuasive. So if this court addresses this claim, despite the fact that it was also not raised below, we submit that there was no plain error here, and Esch is not entitled to relief on this claim. Mr. Apple did not get to any of his remaining claims. I believe I've addressed all those in brief, but if this court has any questions on any of the remaining claims, they're all claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. We would submit they're either the record's either sufficient on direct appeal to reject them or that the record is insufficient. I'd be happy to any questions or answer any questions if you have any. Otherwise, I will submit that on brief. If there are no further questions, we would ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 8 minutes and 44 seconds.
8 minutes and 44 seconds, Mr. Rappel.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm not sure I'll need all that time, but just a couple points to respond to. The state's asking what our remedy would be. Absolutely, the remedy should be a new trial. The remedy should be that Mr. Esch get a fair trial as consistent with his constitutional right to one. He should be given a trial that doesn't inject confusion by the court improperly instructing on a defense that wasn't there and trial counsel muddying the record the way he did. That's exactly what the remedy should be.
What would be the jury instruction in regard to alcohol?
Well, I'm not sure there should be a jury instruction that relates to alcohol. I read the state on that. What I'm saying is by introducing that possible defense, a potential beneficial defense to the defendant, and then having the defense counsel at times appeared to eliminate any potential advantage that instruction would have been given. And then to, I think that's what's so stunning about the manner in which sudden quarrel was instructed. Because in sudden quarrel it says individual peculiarities such as intoxication. So they actually singled out intoxication, which happened to be the exact same instruction that was given as a defense for the two more serious charges. But all of a sudden in the jury's mind, it's not a defense to the less serious charge. And again, if a new trial were granted, I think the better defense would be no intoxication defense, argue sudden quarrel, argue that the statements that were made about you're crazy just like your father caused him to snap and caused him to lack the premeditation and contemplative intent to commit murder, but to commit more of a manslaughter under the provocation of those. So I believe that's the better and more appropriate defense in this case. And that'd be the only way, I think, to remedy this error would be to give him a new trial, give him that opportunity. Because again, the only reason there's confusion with the jury instructions is because the court instructed on intoxication. If you take that out of it, again, because intoxication was singled out as in the sudden quarrel instruction as one of the peculiarities you cannot consider, but then the court instructed on intoxication for first and second degree murder, that naturally causes confusion. And again, as we look, as I said earlier, through the prism of this case, we must focus on, from the perspective of the jury, did it cause confusion? And the way it was argued and the way it was instructed and the instructions themselves contradict each other, counsel's contradicting those instructions, Mr. Esch simply did not get a fair jury trial in this particular case. Now, to touch on one more thing regarding the burden of proof, the state is trying to argue that State versus Barber somehow eliminates my contention that by the court not instructing that the burden doesn't shift on first and second degree murder, that completely misapplies. Barber is absolutely distinguishable from the present case. In Barber, the only crime he was charged with was first degree sexual assault. There was only one element instruction given. What makes this case different, and this case, again, more confusing to the jury, is that there were multiple crimes that the jury was instructed on. On one of the crimes, the murder, it never said on murder, on first-degree murder, second-degree murder, and manslaughter, never did the court put in the language, the burden stays on the state and the burden never shifts to the defendant, right? But on the use of a firearm charge and the possession of a firearm by a prohibited person charge, the court included that language that the burden never shifts. So unlike Barber, where the only element instruction given never had the language about the burden never shifting, in this case, we've got three crimes saying no mention that it shifts, and two crimes saying that it doesn't shift. And so that, again, causes confusion. So now we've got not one, but two, I would argue, two errors in jury instructions on a first-degree murder case. And so for those reasons, again, I think that you can't say that this verdict was surely unattributable to those errors. And for those reasons, I know it's hard to give new trials on murder cases, but in this case, I think it's one of those rare cases where it has to be given because the law and the evidence in the record supports it. And I know nothing else. If you have any more questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Counsel, that concludes arguments in State versus Esch. And that also concludes arguments for the day. So the court is adjourned, and you are excused.